Welcome to The Common Share, a podcast about cooperative businesses. I'm Asa Marshall with Cooperatives First, an organization that promotes co-op business development in rural and Indigenous communities across Western Canada. We're recording in Saskatoon on Treaty 6 territory and the traditional homeland of the Métis. This year at Cooperatives First, we're focused on helping groups start childcare cooperatives to help meet the need for childcare across the Western provinces. Thanks to a grant from Prairies Economic Development Canada, we've hired a community engagement coordinator who's focused on childcare, created specific resources and supports for people starting childcare co-ops, and launched the Create Your Own Space campaign to promote cooperatives as an excellent way to meet local childcare needs. To help guide us in this initiative, we are privileged to have an advisory committee that consists of today's guests, Sue Delaney and Dr. Susan Prentice. These two brilliant experts have studied and advocated for the childcare field for many years, and we had an engaging conversation about what the childcare landscape looks like in Canada, the most recent government policies that intend to address the childcare shortages, the vision they have for what the childcare system should look like in Canada, and how cooperatives can help. This was a fascinating and engaging conversation about childcare in Canada that helps us understand how things stand and what's being done to make it better for everyone. Yeah, so can each of you just introduce yourself and why you're involved in the childcare space?
Well, I'm Susan Prentice. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Manitoba. I hold the Duff Roblin Professor of Government there. And my whole academic career, which has now been a long time, is focusing on child and family policy and ways to support women and families. I work as a feminist sociologist. I've been involved in childcare advocacy for a long time, and this project just was irresistible.
And my name's Sue Delaney. I'm one of the two Sues here. And my role right now is the chairperson of Childcare Now Saskatchewan. I'm a longtime advocate for early learning childcare, but my past roles have also been in childcare as the children's advocate for Saskatoon. And then my last career was working in the justice milieu as the executive director of the Elizabeth Fry Society, and then back into childcare working on this project.
Can you describe sort of the landscape of childcare in Western Canada, how it is right now?
So Canada really has a different childcare system in each province it's in. Childcare is a provincial responsibility, and so province to province and across the territories, it's very, very different. Nevertheless, there are some patterns across all of Western Canada. On average, most parents were paying very high costs. On average, most parents had a hard time finding childcare. And on average, the staff who worked in the programs didn't earn enough. And on average, because of inadequate public investments, the quality wasn't as high as we always wanted it to be. So this scenario starts to change in 2021. The federal government launched the Canada-wide Early Learning and Childcare Agreements. And this was the first time since World War II that the federal government has tried to really make a difference in childcare. And they've done a lot of very important things. So across the three Prairie provinces, Manitoba and Saskatchewan will each get over $1 billion a year over the 5 years of funding. And Alberta's going to get almost $3.9 billion. And with this money, big changes are coming. People mainly call it the $10 a day plan, but it's much more than that. It's also going to include expansion. But one of the things we really would like it to do is to solve childcare deserts. A childcare desert is a postal code where at least three children are trying to use one childcare space, meaning not enough access. And the bad news is that 92% of Saskatchewan is a childcare desert. Yeah. 76% of Manitoba is a childcare desert. And in Alberta, it's only 61%. So that's what we've got out there.
So Susan's right. Across Canada, it's diverse from province to province, but it's a great opportunity for every province. And it was certainly a great opportunity for Saskatchewan because we had such low enrollment in not-for-profit licensed childcare. So this was a very welcomed agreement coming to our province. And I think the thing that was really beneficial for all of us across Canada was this was a time, too, where women's labor force participation was really acknowledged. You know, the pandemic helped us a little bit with that. But also it also pointed out, you know, things that I think we've known for a long time about how important the early years were, not only to children's growth and capabilities as they enter the school system, but also to parents, you know, working in the economy and things like that. And one of the really great things about this whole initiative was it was going to be transformational. Like, and those were the words that were used, and they were inspiring, and they were things that advocates have wanted to hear for, well, 50 years, you know, and for myself, 35. Mm-hmm. So very welcomed in the province. The challenge too, though, is that, you know, the promises made from each province through this agreement are different. They're similar in lots of ways. There was kind of three prongs to this, and it was to assist with the cost, and it was to, you know, improve the working conditions for employees, and a third one was for it to be Indigenous. Yeah. And recognize the importance, I would say, of diversity within the system itself, but to be a complete change and to really set Canada apart yet again from the rest of the world.
Yeah, and we've said for a long time, everybody depends on somebody who depends on childcare, but that's really, the penny really dropped for lots of people. The problem is that each province and territory has made big promises for expansion, but we don't really have a very good infrastructure for figuring out how to grow the services that modern families need. Across Canada, about 70% of spaces in childcare centres are not-for-profit, or a tiny share are public, and the other remaining one-third-ish are offered by for-profit entrepreneurs. And so this is a sort of a delicate moment where the not-for-profit sector wants to grow, provide more services, provide good quality. It's a moment undoubtedly where entrepreneurs are looking to figure out how they can cash in on this new interest and this steady stream of public funding. And it's a moment for lots of innovation in thinking about how to deliver and design startup. So that's really what this expansion project's going to try.
Our federal government is clear that it should be not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. And one of the provinces across Canada, Alberta, has decided that they would like part of their infrastructure money to go to for-profit and part for not-for-profit, which is causing a bit of a chaos throughout the rest of Canada. Mm-hmm. And as Susan mentioned too, different provinces are either ahead or in the momentum and how they move forward, either through their buildings or their capital or their infrastructure or their workforce or their advocacy. So it's a bit of a, you know, a puzzle from coast to coast to coast. And I'd say our northern areas, our more remote areas, are challenging too. So this has been a huge initiative in a very short period of time. The initiative started like 2020 to 21 to 26. We only have so many years to do something that I think has taken our other, you know, European countries 20, 25 years to actually figure out, to do well, and they're still making changes. So this will not be done by 2026, by no means, but it will be a really great start to something that a lot of us know how important it is.
So I gave the figures that across Canada, you know, out of all the spaces, about 70% of them are not-for-profit. But in some provinces, the share is much higher. And in some provinces, in fact, they dominate. And there's a lot of reason to be concerned. I mean, one of the things we saw in the pandemic, you know, this is tragic news, but we saw in services for older people, right, the very different illness and death rates in for-profit services. When you work with vulnerable people, when you're primarily taking care of needy people, when your services really care, it's a bad fit with a profit motive, because the way you make profits in caring services is you cut the care, right? You take corners, you don't hire trained people. You do a race for the bottom. When you move up in scale, we know that in countries where there's a high share of for-profit care, they get together as a lobby, they put political pressure on regulations, they say things like, do you really need 2 years of training for the qualified staff? Is 1 year enough? Do you really need that much outdoor playground? You know, and this, they change the regulatory environment in which they work. And so in places where there's a high rate of commercial care, you know, the standards are lower. That's not to say every for-profit childcare is a bad childcare. But another thing to throw in the mix, in addition to downward pressure on quality and downward pressure on regulations and the harms to staff, if public assets if parents, for example, build a child care center and their fees pay it and government and taxpayer dollar goes into it, at the end of the day, there's a private asset that somebody owns. And a for-profit operator can take that asset that got paid for by taxpayers, yeah, and at the end of the day, they can close it down and sell it off. But, and so if you want to steward public money, you have to put up guardrails.
Yeah.
And so this is also where the importance of the not-for-profit sector.
And I think people are always confused between for-profit and not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And by no means do we say a not-for-profit should not make money. They should, but that money should go back into the initiative and for us, the center itself, into wages and working conditions and also into furniture and toys. And when profit is one of the main goals, then it's exactly what Susan says. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, the cutting of services that are needed.
Right. The challenge is that the for-profit sector has access to capital, has project management skills, has deep pockets, is coming in, looks like it could solve a problem. So it's tempting for governments. It's also tempting because the not-for-profit sector is a whole bunch of small independents. There's very little scale. There's very little coordination. There's lots of interest, but quite handicapped. I mean, you have to go out and get a loan if you want to start a child care center. How do people do that? And so we're in a vulnerable moment where we want to grow, but some of the foundational stuff that will support growth in the quality sector has yet to be developed.
Well, and one of the provinces right now in the prairies is moved their child care sector from Manitoba's under the auspices of education, so is Saskatchewan. Alberta was under Child and Family Services. They've just moved it to, it's called JET, Jobs, Economy, and Trade. You know, I mean, will it be bad? Maybe not in the long run, but it sends a different signal too, right? So there's danger in that too, I think.
You know, in the education sector, you know, two of the Prairie provinces, we understand that children should be in purpose-built spaces. We understand that teachers should all be trained. We understand that schools should be quality places for children. We understand that they're not-for-profit public assets, right? None of those foundational assumptions are in place when you just think of child care as a for-profit service.
Absolutely. And this whole initiative is supposed to be about building public policy around early learning child care, not about just creating jobs and moving the economy. Those are benefits, yes, but the main goal is to have a system that we can all count on, like we can count on our education system, well, in some provinces, and our healthcare system, well, in some provinces. We can admit a lot of our systems are in chaos and deficits right now, but those things will change, and childcare needs to be one of those systems that families can count on.
How does a lack of childcare spaces affect families, individual families that can't access the space they need?
Well, I think number one was through COVID. It really showed what, you know, what happens when there's no places and spaces for our children. I always struggle with the fact that we're trying to grow our province and make it a great place to live and things like that. I always wonder why we don't invest more in saying it's a great place to work and raise a family if you have supports where you can go to your employment or work or whatever it is, school or training, and you know that your children are well taken care of and they're in a really nurturing, a healthy environment that makes them grow and expand and learn. And when they come home, you know, be part of a familial setting that is really, really positive. You know, it makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. It's 2024, but still we know that the presence of children is really changes women's labor force.
Yes.
This is what we really know. So when we talk about the effects on families, we're predominantly talking about the effects on women. It's women who drop out of the labor market, who take a long leave, who drop to part-time. In a partnership, maybe that's a long-term deal that works well for the family, but a woman can be a divorce or a death away from poverty. She will be poorer in her old age if she hasn't contributed during her working life. Women who take time out of the labor market don't see their careers advance. So there are very strong gender equity effects on families. And, you know,
well, you did a little bit of an economic analysis on what happens to a woman who takes her time out of, you know, the workforce and her loss in earnings and whatever. I mean,
it carries through across a whole across a whole lifetime. And so because of the lack of services, the risk and vulnerability tends to fall on mothers in an unequal way that it doesn't fall on fathers. in Quebec, which more than almost 30 years ago now, really transformed its childcare system, planners were astonished to find that when they started rolling out $5 a day daycare in 1997, the number of women in Quebec, mothers who wanted to work, just jumped. Quebec, in fact, grew the GDP of the province. Almost 4% more women in the labor market than in nearby provinces, because when you make services available and people can find work and family balance, you can tap into a labor force that wants to work. Quebec also saw, and this was an unexpected finding, a small increase in the birth rate, because maybe a family really did want that third child but just couldn't see making it work. And when some of the economic pressures goes on, you can actually support families in making the choices that they want. So when you start tugging at the effects of lack of childcare, they're big, you know. A small town can't recruit a doctor or a nurse, can't keep a principal, can't start up a business. Productivity suffers, right? There's a whole cascade of effects, but lots of this relies on the fact that we've simply thought that families are a private responsibility. Really, it's mothers who'll take care of it. And we're in this big wrenching transition to understanding that it really does take a village, and it's time for us to step up.
And it's really interesting to me that a lot of older men in business, that we've been talking about this for a lot of years, but, and I mean older men who are now grandpas and whose daughters all have wonderful careers, have now recognized that it's not the same way it used to be, and perhaps their company, their organization, whatever, needs to be investing more into this, because they're working themselves too, and they see the need of their own families in a way that they didn't see before. So that change has really taken place over the last few years.
I'll tell you about my own family. 18 years ago, when my niece was born in Toronto, you know, her two moms didn't have, you know, ordinary jobs, fairly young women, and Jamie's in daycare, and it's costing $90 a day. And my dad's helps them out. He ended up paying their childcare costs for a year. And he said to me, "Do you know how expensive childcare is?" I said, "Dad, I actually do." And that's what we've been working on. And the penny dropped for him in a way that he had never understood what this actually did.
Yeah.
He's like, "I understand what you're doing." He said, "That is very important work."
it's always fun to be part of those conversations where you hear somebody go, "Oh my God."
You can literally see a light bulb.
We get what you've been saying.
Well, and even with, you know, it is usually women who drop out of the labor force, and how many families can exist on one income really anymore too? So it just...
And that's still, you know, I mean, I have a lot of friends who hold out and say that's ridiculous that, you know, women still have to be working in this day and age or whatever. Well, A, you know, women contribute to 50% of the brain power of this, you know, whole world we live in. And they want to, you know, women want careers and are great in careers and have contributed in ways that they never had a chance before. So why wouldn't we want to support the families that way?
And we've seen a tremendous public policy success. Like, if you've never thought government policy really touched your life, here's one. I mean, there were families that were spending as much as $18,000 to $20,000 a year on childcare, because that's what infant care costs in many big cities in this country. And many of those families now are paying $10 a day, right? It's $2,600
well,
a year.
Next
that
to your
money is available for all kinds of other family purposes.
Yeah. Next to your mortgage, childcare can be your most expensive cost. And then groceries, believe it or not. So it's your mortgage, childcare, and then, you know, groceries and you know.
So if we want to make life affordable for families, this is one of the ways to make it go.
So we've changed Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I think, haven't we?
So, yeah.
Childcare is there somewhere.
Yeah. And then we talked about, too, not only the impact it has on individual families, but then how does that spread out to the wider community that they live in as well? Like, what is the impact on the place where they live?
Mm-hmm. Well, that idea that everybody depends on someone who depends on childcare.
Yeah.
I think the pandemic really did... reveal how much the formal economy rests on caregiving work, right? Without buses and infrastructure to get your grocery store stocker to the grocery store, there's no food on your shelves. Without childcare supporting the people, the parents in the workforce, you know, they're not there at the work. So it matters to all of us at all stages of our life, whether or not we are parents.
Well, even caregivers who are caring for others have children themselves who need other care.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a drop-down effect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially for rural communities, I mean, you guys already mentioned, you know, how do you recruit someone to work at the healthcare center or in the school?
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you if they can't find childcare, they're not going to move to your community.
So I had given you the provincial data on deserts, right? 92% of Albert, you know, of Saskatchewan's children live in a desert.
Mm-hmm.
But if you drill down, those are worse in rural and northern and remote communities. Cities still don't have enough, but in general, there's less bad access in the cities. And in a small town, one of the things that a childcare facility brings are good jobs, usually women's jobs, because even in 2024, 96% of the people working in childcare are women. It's very rewarding work. But it's highly feminized. It's the most feminized job sector in Canada. But if you can open a childcare in a small town and you can create, 12 new jobs, you've just created employment, and then that employment has knockoff effects that induces spending in your town, and it's a virtuous circle.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so we've talked about this a little bit, but I'm interested in if you can describe the government's current programs and how they aim to address childcare issues. You talked about that a bit.
Well, it would be really important for us to talk about, too, what's happening in the rural areas.
True.
And the rural areas, especially in Saskatchewan right now. You know, we've heard a lot from rural and Indigenous communities on, you know, how to set up childcare and how to set up, a system of support in their communities. And there's a lot of frustration because we have had some really successful early learning programs in some really unique initiatives, but they always implode. It's always hanging on by somebody in the community with goodwill and not a policy to kind of support it. So we're looking at the transformation right now of trying to really put a gap on those childcare deserts, especially in the rural areas. But it's a challenge on how we do it. And it's a challenge on how it's supported. And right now, too, one of the government ways of increasing the places and spaces is to enhance family childcare. And that's people providing care in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not against family childcare in any way, shape, or form, but I don't think it's a way to grow the system in a positive way for all of us, for growth. I think it's a really good interim solution. And, you know, myself personally, my family has been part of the unlicensed family childcare homes and situations that have been fabulous, but they aren't all fabulous all across, you know, the provinces. And it's really hard to monitor that. And we do hear a lot from the Indigenous community, too, that they are not that happy or supportive of just family child care. They would rather more center-based care. So, you know, we've got a lot of work to do and have a lot of questions to answer on how we grow this system.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of challenges. And then even if you want to build a center in a smaller remote area, where do you get the staffing? And where are they coming from? And can they afford housing in that area? You know, housing and childcare kind of go together these days, too, because housing is so expensive.
Oh, yeah. Terribly so. So I've studied how governments in Canada have approached childcare policy for over 100 years. And what you found was that in the early days, childcare was seen to belong to a basket of kind of welfare policies. Orphans, basically people who, you know, weren't seen as productive, kind of the forgotten. And most of the time, most provinces stuck childcare in whatever they called family, social services, community services, welfare departments. And the spending was pretty much limited. Government's role was pretty much limited to ensuring a floor of safety, licensing it if it got built, and then providing fee subsidies for the poor. Most governments didn't see themselves playing a role in starting up services or in promoting this. And so in recent years, as the file has moved in many provinces from welfare to education, and people are starting to realize, whoa, this is economic infrastructure, family policy is economic policy, everybody depends on somebody who depends on childcare, we better do it. Governments are in a bit of a shock because they are trying to transform their own approaches. And we're in a bit of a moment of lag. We don't really have these mechanisms in place. From a public administration point of view, it's a time of big transition.
Absolutely. And you did mention sort of childcare workers. I know that it can be, it's a great way to create jobs in a community, but it can also be difficult to find and also isn't that well paid of a position, considering the level of skill and dedication you need to do one of these jobs. Do you guys want to talk about that a bit?
One of the economists in Canada who does a great deal of work on childcare policy says that this is one of the only sectors where we demand post-secondary training, but we pay high school wages.
Yeah.
That's a punchline right there.
Yeah. Is it ever a punchline. And I've always wondered, after advocating and being in this system for so long, why you would even go and train for, a couple of years and expect minimum wage. And I always think about my son, who is a millwright and an electrician, who went to school for, a short amount of time and then worked in the community and did an apprenticeship or whatever, and then started right off the bat at a very high wage. And he might say it's not as high as it should be, but, way higher than somebody who is caring for children, 8 to 10 hours a day. And your eye is never left off the prize when you're looking after children. And I'm not saying, apprentice or, people working in those other fields aren't, but the wages have been ridiculous. So right now, what we're trying to figure out is, what is an acceptable wage? And so that's something that provinces are struggling with from coast to coast to coast. And that, we've got the $10 a day, figured out. We know we need to help parents out. But then how do we grow this with the right amount of staff? Yeah. And what is, and I hate the word wage. I think it's what's the salary grid. Mm-hmm. And what supports, and I mean pensions and supports and training and things like that, do we expect? So I would suggest that every province right now is struggling with that, and there is no, I don't think there's one formula that fits everywhere right now, but we have a ballpark with what we think,
Across the country, we know that there are shortfalls of trained, certified early childhood educators. Mm-hmm. Each province has different criteria for training. Our two provinces say you need 2 years of post-secondary. Alberta, where there's a high rate of for-profit, says only 1 year. So there's some of those links again. But the challenge, of course, is that we've come out of this history where, mothers used to do it for free, or nice ladies who just wanted to work with children did it for pin money.
Yeah.
And we didn't see it as a profession. We don't see it as skilled work. And there's been this legacy of not being willing to pay. So, in the United States, labor economists have said that there is no other post-secondary training you can do that will give you a smaller return on your education than working in childcare. The only blessing is that the work is intrinsically satisfying. It is joyful work to work with children, and it is transformative for you and the children you work with when it's done well.
Yes.
So that is the pleasure. But the sector has very little difficulty recruiting people. What we have a terrible time doing is retaining. And this is because we still pay high school wages. And it's a legacy, again, of this idea that it's not serious work. You don't need to pay for it.
You don't need to train.
As though we would accept teachers who are unskilled or untrained, or nurses, because back in the day, once upon a time, you didn't even need to train to be a nurse.
And
we're 100 years behind on respecting this work.
Maybe more than 100. And there's been a comparison, because childcare has fallen under the auspices of education, that perhaps childcare should be paid the same as we'd pay an educational assistant working in the system at a bare minimum. And, and even the educational assistants will say, we're not paid enough and we don't have enough supports or things like that. But, there's a big difference between a minimum wage job and, a job within the educational sector.
So these ambitious targets that all provinces have signed on to in return for getting these billions coming from Ottawa, they all talk about major growth, and it means big, big ramping up of the labor force. So this is also going to have a cascade of positive effects, if it's done right, on our post-secondary, on towns where there's colleges and universities. We're creating new career ladders. But those institutions also aren't yet set up for success. There's a labor economist in Toronto who's looked across the country to figure out how long it's going to take each province to train up enough staff.
Okay, this is depressing.
She's told us here in Manitoba it's going to take 18 years for us to train up enough staff to meet our promise.
Well, and ours was more than 20, wasn't it?
I think you were close to 32 years.
So,
again, right, it's a lot to tackle all at once. And it asks governments to approach taking the sector seriously. And this is another big big shift that's at play.
Well, I assume the government has a big role to play in that, because obviously when you're trying to keep the cost to families of childcare low, but you want the wages to be higher, how do you balance that?
We have an aspirational program or project or initiative that we're watching unfold with a million convoluting areas to work in. You know, from province to province, and I'll use Saskatchewan as one, a very tenuous relationship with the federal government to the provincial government. You know, and our budget just came out yesterday, and, you know, I'm watching very closely of how much money did our government put in of their own money towards the system. From my perspective, not much. You know, they're relying on federal dollars, but all the other systems have to be changed too, and it's a cascading effect on how we do this.
When we decide that something is a public good, we share the cost of it, right? We decided just before I was born that healthcare was going to be a public good for all Canadians, and we all agreed to share the cost of it, right? We no longer ask people to privately pay for their own healthcare, and we're the better off as a country for that. Around the turn of the last century, we figured this out for education, right? We stopped having one-room schoolhouses in small towns, and we built a public education system for everybody. We're in this tipping point for childcare too. We're trying to move what's primarily been seen as either a private responsibility or just something for the voluntary sector to do, to kind of slowly transform it into a public service. And these are enormous growing pains, but it's a tremendous moment of opportunity.
Yes,
absolutely.
And when we get it right, it's going to be great.
Well, I guess I wanted to ask then, I mean, we've talked about the kind of funds and the programs that the government provides, but at the end of the day, who actually creates the childcare centers? Like, how do they get built and run at that end?
And this is where the rubber hits the road. We don't yet have very effective intermediate levels of scale to actually take a community that needs childcare, put it together with the right skill set and project management team to actually build a childcare center for that facility. We need a bridge from need to service, and we don't yet have that. But in the short term, one of the things that can be done, and it's the initiative that Cooperative First is spearheading, is to try to figure out how in communities to bring the right governance structure together of stakeholders who bring the right skill set, who can help incubate these programs and get them starting. And it's already paying off.
In spades. I would also suggest too that in the future, just how we decide that we need a school in a different area, that is another public service, that's how childcare will be probably figured out in the future. But we're not there yet. So Susan's right, the Cooperators First is a perfect approach on how to, for us to at least get a few services in the queue so that when the big transformation happens, when it really is seen as a public service, they will be there for, you know, ready and able to make the switch over. So right now our challenge is, how do we get to, you know, areas that are in need? I mean, do they just put up their hands and call us? You know, no. That's the quandary. Like, so we have to cast out a big net in a variety of different ways to say, does your community need this? Are you interested? Is your municipality interested? Have your mayors talked about this? Or, you know, you as, you know, a school or whatever? So there's a variety of ways for people to, you know, show an interest, and we can help them.
I hope this doesn't sound too corny, but I sometimes think about that starfish story. You know the story, there's a person on the beach and she's picking up starfishes and she's flinging them back into the ocean. And someone says, you're not really making much of a difference. And she says, well, it makes a difference to that starfish.
Yeah.
Right. What Co-ops First is doing, there's a team of developers who will help spark enthusiasm in communities, bring the right people together. Work with them as they do the long, complicated work of putting in funding applications and building it up, and be that bridge that doesn't really exist to help communities get started. For the moment, it's, if we're lucky, it's going to be at least 15. That was the first target. Mm-hmm. Looks like that'll get beat pretty fast. You know, hundreds of thousands of childcare short. It's still just starfish. But for every community that gets services where they didn't have it, right? It means the world.
Well, and it's certainly, this whole project has certainly expedited this process, because if we didn't have the Cooperators First to help with this whole initiative, then you're depending on almost a defunct system to help you support with oodles and wades of minutiae that are hard to figure out, mm-hmm. where you've got some faces and places and spaces mm-hmm. to say, help me do this, and we're able to help do that and expedite this process in a way that I would suggest most provinces haven't seen yeah. for a long time. And we've heard that from our province, even our government that does, you know, typically help initiative startupers saying, oh, maybe can we borrow that form that you've got? Or, you know, this is a really smart way to do business. Mm-hmm. So
didn't we hear that your government has realized what a resource this is? And
yeah.
you've even put a link to this
on
the
which is
the government of Saskatchewan.
Which is yeah. almost unbelievable, yeah. actually.
Mm-hmm.
But we are expediting that process.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Well, and in your time working with us on this project, which has been incredible, what do you think about the co-op model being a fit for creating childcare? Like, do you think that it's a good model for creating this kind of interim system?
So when I first heard about this, my first reflex was, oh no, please don't. It's too much work for parents. Because there was a wave of co-op childcares that got set up, which I knew best, in Ontario in the 70s. And the model was the kind of the parent co-op on the floor, right? Everybody had to do 6 or 8 hours a month, and you had to be there, and you had to build the shelves, and you had to, you know, mop yeah. the floors, and you had to bake the muffins. And you take a busy working parent at the busiest time of their life, and then you need them to put in more hours. I'm like, it's a burden. It's yeah. too much of a burden. And so what I think the truly innovative spark of this model is, it's the cooperative principle at the level of governance. It's not at the level of on the floor, you'll
yeah.
schedule your shift.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's bringing together the right people in a community to work together in a governance model, which maybe in fact could incubate more than one program, mm-hmm. could in a region incubate a couple, where you could have a common board that could run a number of facilities
and get some
multiplier.
Or
effects.
Already may have a board there that's
yeah,
already
yeah.
Developed that can, you know, take over this. And I also think too that when we first heard about it, we, you know, I sort of had the same reaction of, oh no, because we want public policy. We just want that public policy to be developed. We want to go from zero to hero right away.
Yeah.
But we know that it's going to take a long time to develop. So this is a really creative way to, I think, demonstrate the demand and to help yeah. our starfish communities and to really do something positive to get those places and spaces ready for, mm-hmm. you know, that public shift.
Yeah. The model you're kind of talking about is the client that we had in Maple Creek,
exactly.
whom
yeah.
it wasn't the individual
yeah.
parents who came together and
yeah.
had to do all the work. It
yeah.
was the town, the First Nation,
yeah.
and the RM
yeah.
that came together, and mm-hmm. those institutions did the heavy lifting so
yeah.
that the parents mm-hmm. could still be involved,
yeah.
but it wasn't all on their shoulders.
Right.
And it would be great to see more communities being able to do that.
They didn't have to do the bake sale to pay for the cost of the building.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, exactly.
I sometimes use the metaphor of it's the difference between a parent council in a school.
Absolutely.
There will still be a school. There will still be a quality program. The school is there for you whether or not you join the PTA. You can if you want and if you have the time and the energy. But childcare most of the time will not exist if parents don't do it. So to bring in other stakeholders that can provide the organizational continuity so parents can be there as well, but it doesn't all ride on parents at
yeah.
the hardest time in their life. I
yeah.
think that is really the
parents should be an advisory. They should not
yeah.
be the, you know,
yeah.
the co-engineers of everything.
That's
and
right.
to, you know, to figure out how to find the capital for the building
yes.
and how much should we pay people or what does staffing complement look like.
Yeah.
That's not their role. Advisory, yes. And utilizing that place and space. That's
right.
their role.
That's right. So this is just a way to take the principles of community economic development, of local support, building social solidarity, and bringing more players in, right, to spread some of the work
yeah.
around so that there's more institutional strength and capacity and depth on boards. They'll keep doing their thing. Parents can come, they use, they stay, they go, but the institution itself is on a much firmer footing and a stronger foundation.
So I think
Absolutely.
You can see we're excited about
yeah.
the actual project and we're excited about the opportunities
yeah.
and we believe in it and we see a lot of benefits
yeah.
to all the provinces. And I think that this whole project will be a demonstration site for the rest of Canada. So
yeah.
we're excited.
Yeah. Well, and At Cooperatives First, I can say we're so excited to have the two of you helping us with this in advisory capacity, helping us to help communities. We obviously are really dedicated to seeing this improve as well. So thank you guys so much for helping us out with this initiative. Yeah. And bringing all of your depth of experience and knowledge on this topic has been incredible.
Thank you for joining us. For more on us and what we do, visit cooperativesfirst.com. If you need resources for starting your own co-op, check out coopcreator.com. It's a great resource site that has everything you need to get a co-op up and running. To give us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or on Twitter as coops_first.